Outbreak of cattle disease reported from northern Matabeleland. Losses 60%, repeat 60%. Company veterinarian recognizes symptoms similar to peste bovine epidemic in Italy 1880. Disease also known as a rinderpest. No known treatment. Possible losses 100%, failing isolation and control. Urgently request authority to destroy and burn all cattle in central province to prevent southward spread. While he feigned astonishment and shock at the first paragraph, Ralph ran his eye swiftly down the remaining text. It was a rare opportunity to read a decoded BSA company report. The fact that Jordan had handed it to him was a measure of his agitation. There were lists of police strengths and dispositions, summaries of monies held and dispensed, administrative requisitions, recommendations for trading licenses, and the roster of mineral claims filed in Bulawayo. Ralph passed the sheet back to his brother with a suitably solemn expression. At the head of the roster of new claims, he had seen a block of 40 square miles registered in the name of Wankie Coal Mining Company. That was the name he and Harry Mellow had agreed upon for their company, and Ralph glowed with satisfaction that did not show on his face. Harry must have got the women and Jonathan safely back to Bulawayo, and he had wasted no time in filing the claims. Once again, Ralph congratulated himself on his choice of partner and brother-in-law. The only prickle of uncertainty was the rider to the roster that St. John had sent. Advise soonest company policy regarding coal and base metals claims. Register 198 in favour of Wankie Coal Mining Company, held in abeyance pending clarification. The claims were filed, but not yet confirmed. However, Ralph would have to worry about that later. Right now, he had to concentrate on Jordan's apprehensions. Papa is right in the path of this thing, this rinderpest. He has worked so hard all his life and had such rotten luck. Oh, Ralph, it can't happen to him, not again. Jordan stopped as another thought occurred to him. And you too. How many bullock teams did you have in Matabeleland, Ralph?
None.
None? I don't understand.
I sold every last ox and wagon to the Zederbergs.
Jordan stared at him.
When?
He asked at last.
Yesterday.
When did you leave Bulawayo, Ralph?
What's that got to do with it? Ralph demanded.
The telegraph lines, they were cut, you know, deliberately, in four places.
Extraordinary. Who would have done a thing like that?
I don't even dare ask. Jordan shook his head. And on second thoughts, I don't want to know when you left Bulawayo, or whether or not Papa sold his stock as suddenly as you did yours.
Come on, Jordan, I'll take you to lunch at the club. A bottle of bubbly will console you for belonging to a family of rogues and for working for another.
The Kimberley Club had a most undistinguished facade. Since its foundation, it had been enlarged twice, and the additions were glaringly apparent. Unbaked Kimberley brick, abutting upon galvanised iron and finally fired red brick. The iron roof was unpainted, but there were strange little touches of pretension. The white picket fence, the front door glazed in Venetian glass. Until a man had become a member, he could not consider himself truly to have arrived in South Africa. Membership was so prized that Barney Bonato, who, despite his millions, had been steadfastly blackballed, was finally tempted to sell out his diamond holdings to Mr. Rhodes only after he had been promised the coveted membership as part of the deal. Even then, with the pen in his hand, Bonato had hesitated over signing the contract.
"How do I know they still won't chuck me out again as soon as I've signed?" "My dear fellow, we will make you a life governor,"
Mr. Rhodes assured him, offering the final plum that was irresistible to the little slum-born cockney. On his first night as a member of the club, Bonato had strode up to the long bar dressed like a theatrical impresario and ordered a round of drinks for all, then flashed a magnificent 10-carat blue-white diamond ring on his third finger. "What do you gents think of that, eh?" One of the members studied it for a moment and remarked, "Clashes awfully with the colour of your fingernails, old boy." Then, ignoring the proffered drink, he sauntered through to the billiard room, and everybody, except Barney Bonato and the barman, trooped out after him. It was that kind of club. Ralph's and Jordan's own membership had been assured as soon as they came of age, for not only was their father a founder member and a life governor, but he was also a holder of the Queen's Commission and a gentleman. These things counted at the Kimberley Club, ahead of vulgar wealth. The porter greeted the brothers by name and put their cards up on the inn board. The barman behind the long bar poured Jordan a pink gin and Indian tonic, without being ordered, though he turned to Ralph apologetically. "We don't see you often enough, Mr. Ralph. Is it still Glenlivet whisky, sir, water, and no ice?" In the dining room they both ordered from the carving trolley. Juicy young lamb, with the subtle taste of the Karoo herbs on which it had barely been weaned. Served with parsleyed baby new potatoes. Jordan declined the champagne that Ralph suggested. "I'm a working man," he smiled. "My taste is simpler than yours. Something like the Chateau Margaux 73 would suit me better." The 20-year-old claret cost 4 times more than any champagne on the wine list. "By God," said Ralph ruefully, "under that urban veneer you are a true Ballantine after all." "And you must be neck-deep in filthy lucre after that timely sale. It's my brotherly duty to help you get rid of it." "Fire sale price," Ralph demurred, but nodded in appreciation of the claret. They ate in contented silence for a few minutes. Then Ralph picked up his glass. "What does Mr. Rhodes think of the coal deposits that Harry and I pegged?" he asked mildly, pretending to study the ruby lights in the wine, but watching his brother's reaction. He saw the corners of Jordan's mouth quiver with surprise, saw his eyes flare with some other emotion which he could not read, before it was masked. Then Jordan lifted a pink morsel of the lamb on the silver fork, chewed it fastidiously, and swallowed before he asked, "Coal?" "Yes, coal," Ralph agreed. "Harry Mellow and I pegged a huge deposit of high-grade coal in northern Matabeleland. Haven't you seen the filing yet? Hasn't the board approved the register? You must know about it, Jordan." "What a fine wine this is." Jordan inhaled the bouquet. A big, spicy perfume. "Oh, of course the telegraph line has been down. You haven't received it yet." "Ralph, I happen to know through my spies," Jordan said carefully, and Ralph leaned closer to him, "that the club secretary has just received a £20 Stilton from Fortnum's. It should be perfect after the voyage." "Jordan," Ralph stared at him, but Jordan would not look up. "You know I can't say anything," he whispered miserably. So instead they ate the Stilton on water biscuits and accompanied it with a port from the cask that was not listed on the wine card, its existence known only to the privileged members. At last Jordan took the gold hunter from his fob pocket. "I should be getting back. Mr. Rhodes and I are leaving for London at noon tomorrow. There is a great deal to do before we go." However, as they stepped out of the front door of the club, Ralph took his brother's elbow firmly and steered him into De Beers Road, lulling him with a flow of family gossip until they were opposite a pretty red-brick cottage almost hidden by dog roses, its diamond-paned windows curtained with frilled lace and its demure little sign on the gate. "French dressmakers, haute couture, continental seamstresses, specialities for individual tastes." Before Jordan had realized what his brother was about, Ralph had lifted the latch of the gate and was leading him down the walk. Ralph felt that on top of good food and wine, the company of the young ladies whom Diamond Lil chose with such taste and care to ornament Rose Cottage could not fail to soften and relax the tongue of even such a loyal servant as Jordan into indiscreet comment on his master's affairs. Jordan took one pace beyond the gate before he pulled back from Ralph's grasp with unnecessary violence. "What are you doing?" he demanded. He had gone as pale as though a mumba had crossed the path at his feet. "Do you know what that place is?"
"Yes, I do," Ralph nodded. "It's the only whorehouse I know of where a doctor checks the goods on offer at least once a week."
"Ralph, you can't go in there." "Oh, come on now, Geordie," Ralph smiled and took his arm again. "It's me, your brother Ralph. You don't have to put on a show. A salty young bachelor like you, by God, I'll bet there's a plaque on the wall above every bed in there with your name on it." He stopped as he recognized Jordan's real consternation.
"What is it, Geordie?" For once, Ralph was uncertain of himself. Don't tell me you've never had your cuff turned back for you by one of Lil's seamstresses." "I've never set foot in that place." Jordan shook his head vehemently. He had gone pale, and his lips trembled.
"And nor should you, Ralph. You are a married man."
"Oh, Lord, Geordie, don't be daft, lad. Even a solid diet of caviar and champagne can pall after a while. A hunk of country ham and a jug of rough cider makes a nice change."
"Well, that's your business," Jordan flashed at him. "And I don't propose to stand in the street in front of this institution, discussing it."
He turned on his heel and strode away down the sidewalk, a half dozen paces before looking back over his shoulder.
"You would do better to consult your lawyer about your damned coal than—"
Jordan broke off with a stricken expression, clearly horrified by his indiscretion. Then he hurried away towards Market Square. Ralph's jaw hardened. His eyes went cold and hard as polished emeralds. He had got his hint from Jordan, and it hadn't cost him the price of one of Diamond Lil's fancy girls either. The lace curtain in the front window of Rose Cottage lifted, and a pretty dark-eyed lass with a creamy oval face and soft red mouth smiled out at him, shaking her ringlets in invitation to enter.
"Sit on it, dearie," Ralph told her grimly, "and keep it warm for me. I'll be back later."
He ground out the half-smoked Romeo Julietta under his heel and strode away towards Aaron Fagan's office building. Aaron Fagan called them the Wolf Pack. "Mr. Rhodes keeps them chained in specially constructed kennels, but lets them run every now and then just to get a little taste of human flesh." They did not look particularly lupine. There were four of them, soberly dressed men whose ages ranged from late 30s to mid-50s. Aaron introduced each of them individually, and then collectively. "These gentlemen are the De Beers Company permanent legal advisers. I think I am correct in saying that they also act on behalf of the British South Africa Company."
"That is correct, Mr. Fagan," said the senior counsellor. And his colleagues arranged themselves down the opposite side of the long table. Each of them placed his pigskin folder of papers neatly in front of him, and then, like a rehearsed vaudeville team, they looked up in unison. It was only then that Ralph recognized the wolf-like glitter in their eyes.
"In what way can we be of assistance?" "My client is seeking clarification of the mining laws promulgated by the BSA Company," Aaron replied. And 2 hours later, Ralph was groping desperately through a maze of jargon and convoluted legal side roads as he tried to follow the discussion, and his irritation was becoming increasingly obvious. Aaron made a silent plea for patience, and with an effort, Ralph stopped the angry words reaching his lips. Instead, he hunched further down in his chair in a deliberately boorish gesture of defiance. He placed one boot on the polished tabletop, amongst the scattered legal papers, and crossed his other ankle on top of it. For another hour he listened, sinking lower and still lower in his chair, and scowling at the lawyers opposite him, until Aaron Fagan asked humbly, "Does that mean that, in your opinion, my client has not fulfilled the requirements of Section 27B, Clause 5, read in conjunction with Section 7bis?
"Well, Mr. Fagan, we would first have to examine the question of due performance as set out in Section 31, replied the pack leader carefully, smoothing his moustache and glancing at his assistants, who nodded brightly again in concert. "In terms of that section..." Abruptly, Ralph reached the far frontier of his patience. He brought his boots down off the table onto the floor with a crash that startled the four grey-suited men across the table. One of them knocked his folder onto the floor, and papers flew like the feathers when a red caracal cat gets into the henhouse.
"I may not know the difference between due performance and the aperture between your buttocks," announced Ralph, in a voice that made the leader pale and shrink in size. Like all men of words, he had a horror of violence, and that was what he sensed in the gaze with which Ralph fixed him. "However, I do know a wagon load of horse manure when I see one, and this gentleman is grade one horse manure you're giving me."
"Mr. Ballantyne," one of the younger assistants, was bolder than his chief.
I must protest your use of language. Your insinuation...
It is not an insinuation, Ralph rounded on him. I am telling you outright that you're a bunch of bandits. Is that still not clear enough?
How about robbers, then, or pirates?
Sir, the assistant sprang to his feet, flushed with indignation, and Ralph reached across the table and caught him by the front of his stock. He twisted it sharply, cutting off the man's protest before it emerged.
Pray be silent, my good fellow. I'm speaking, Ralph admonished him, and then went on. I am sick of dealing with little thieves. I want to speak to the head bandit. Where is Mr. Rhodes?
At that moment, a locomotive down in the shunting yards whistled. The sound only just carried even in the silence which followed Ralph's question, and Ralph remembered Jordan's excuse for ending lunch the previous day. He released the struggling lawyer so abruptly that the man collapsed back into his chair, fighting for breath.
Aaron, Ralph demanded, what time is it?
8 minutes of noon.
He was fobbing me off. The cunning bastard was fobbing me off.
Ralph whirled and ran from the boardroom.